Hisham Matar was a 19-year-old university student in 1990 when his father, Jawaharlal Matar, was kidnapped by agents working for Muammar Gaddafi and sent to Abu Salim in Tripoli, Libya's most notorious prison. Jawaharlal Matar was a widely respected Libyan businessman and one of Gaddafi's most prominent opponents. At the time he was abducted, he'd already been living in exile in Cairo for 10 years with his wife, also Hisham, and another son, Ziad. For the next 22 years, the family heard little about him, but held on to the hope that he was alive. And in 2012, 5 months after Gaddafi was killed, Hisham returned to Libya to search for his father. He tells that story in a memoir from Random House called The Return. Mr. Matar is the author of two critically acclaimed novels. His first, In the Country of Men, was shortlisted for the Man Booker. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show now. Hello.
Hello.
Weren't you fairly young when your family fled Libya?
I was, yes. I was almost nine, and we went to Kenya for a bit, and then we settled in Egypt.
And before your trip to 2012, had you ever been back to Libya?
No. 2012 was the first time that I went back in 33 years.
Didn't you leave a large extended family behind when you moved into exile?
Yeah, almost everybody was back in Libya. Some members were abroad, and some who were in Libya were able to visit occasionally. But yes, you know, everybody was back.
And were they in danger just simply by guilt by association?
Not in danger, but particularly my maternal family. Life was made a bit more difficult for them. It was more difficult for them to get work. It was more difficult for them to get scholarships, things like that.
Were you able to connect with any of them when you returned?
Yes, I was able to connect with everybody. I am in a slightly curious and amusing position in that I only have one sibling, but I have 130 first cousins. Mm. So I come from a very large family, and that allows such a fascinating access to the place because, you know, one of my cousins is the high judge, but also if you wanted a key cut in the old town, my cousin has a shop there too. So different perspectives into a very small place too. No, Libya is not a very large country, population wise. It's only about 6 million. So I can probably have a contact to about half of those.
Well, a fair amount of it is my family. Desert. Yeah. So although you write very movingly about the Libyan landscape, it sounds quite beautiful.
Yeah, it's a stunning country. I mean, look, I have always been a little bit wary of what I've always seen as the sort of exile's disease to romanticize the country. And whenever somebody would speak that way, I would become very uncomfortable. But when I went back, you know, it is really quite stunning. It's really quite beautiful because you have this 2,000-kilometer coast. You have beautiful layers of history, you know, from the Phoenicians to the Greeks to the Romans to the Ottomans to the Italians to present day. You know, so it's such a deep place historically.
You went back with your wife and your mother.
Yes.
And your father talked about having sneaked in to see his grandparents.
His father.
His
father, yeah.
Had your mother ever gone back?
My mother has only been back once before when we went. So it was fairly intense trip, you know. And one of the things that I try to describe in the book, and really how the book came about, really, is me trying to get to grips with the event of going back and how it felt like crossing this gulf, and it felt dangerous, not in the obvious sense. It felt dangerous, you know, existentially for me, because I had created this life for myself in exile, and going back I thought would be no doubt a disruption to this. I'd spent a long time acquiring skills, learn how to live without my country, learn how to live without people that I love. So going back felt you know, destabilizing in that sense.
Well, how dangerous was it? Because the Arab Spring promised all sorts of wonderful things for the various countries in North Africa and the Middle East. Algeria seems to be struggling to maintain a strong democracy, Morocco to some degree, but Libya almost immediately fell into chaos.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, the response, what we call now the Arab Spring, what happened in Tunisia and in Egypt and in Libya and in Yemen.
I guess Tunisia, actually, is the one that's trying.
The response was very, you know, it's a response to a long history. You know, the memory of a revolution is much older than the memory of its protagonists, you know. So it's very complex what happened at that moment, and what was started at that moment is very complex. And so if we are to judge it against outcomes, we have to also be incredibly specific about what has happened after the events, the various international players that became involved, the roles that they played, the sort of reality that the Gaddafi regime has created over 42 years, the way it's made it very difficult for institutions to function. So we are starting from a very hard place.
And it's even become an issue in American politics because the decision to join the coalition to topple Gaddafi has come up, and also what happened in Benghazi is a major part of the debate, probably come up tonight during the presidential debates. So Libya is still what happened in Libya, separate from what happened in your family, is still an ongoing drama.
Yes, more so for Libyans, of course, but absolutely. It's a very, very complicated situation. I mean, the hope was that, sadly, given the history of American involvement with Libya, has always been very, very much like Britain and many other European countries, is very parasitic. You know, it's really only interested in what it can extract from this place, and it has made, you know, America has made, like Britain and like Italy and France, have made it more difficult for Libyans to do what they did. They extended the life of Gaddafi after 2003. In fact, America and Britain sent Libyan dissidents abroad to Gaddafi to torture them. So these acts of rendition are very well documented. And so these actions have not only extended the life of the dictatorship, but also in very real terms made it more difficult for us to do what we did. And so I'm always wary about, it seems to me very self-indulgent whenever in America or in Britain or in Italy the conversation about Libya is had with how did we, you know, how is this working out for us right now? We are talking about the fate of a country, a fate of people. And so one has to be modest and exact when we talk about these things.
My guest is Hisham Matar. His latest book is a memoir called The Return, Fathers, Sons, and the Land in Between. The return had to do with trying to find out what happened to your father, whether he was alive or not. You'd received some letters during the first 6 years after he was kidnapped, but then nothing afterward. I don't know how much we want to reveal here, but
one of the things that was going on, I mean, I mentioned to you how difficult it was existentially going back, but also one of the things that was going on is me trying to find out what happened to my father, who was a political dissident and exiled, as you mentioned, and he was kidnapped from his home in Cairo in 1990, taken back to Libya.
To a terrible prison.
To an awful situation, and he describes in his letters the prison, the torture. And these letters are quite remarkable, really, because they contain his consciousness. You know, they have his whole self in them. But what happens to him is sadly what happened to several political prisoners in Libya. He disappears. We don't know his fate. Obviously, through the laws of deduction we can say he's not alive, but how, when, what circumstances, where his remains might be, all of this we don't know. And so I went, in going back, I was trying to find out more information. I spent the better part of my life, you know, I'm 45 now, I lost my father when I was 19, and I spent all those 25 years campaigning, looking for him, searching for him in many, many ways. And so the book, in a sense, is an articulation of my consciousness, you know, because one of the things that happens when you have this kind of history, you know, when you have to leave your country, when you can't go back, when you lose your father, when not only my father, but I have cousins and uncles who are also put in political prison, friends of mine. If you have this kind of reality, one of the sensations is that you're being drowned by history. It's as if history has got you by the neck and is pushing you down. So it seemed to me a very interesting artistic, creative exercise to try to create a work of art that becomes an expression of a full consciousness, where you bring up to the surface history and politics, my responses to literature and art and ideas and the landscape, as we were speaking about, and familial relationships. So you bring everything up and you give it equal value, because if you are somebody like me, where you're growing up interested in a painting or a book in such a loud time, and I grew up in what in the Middle East we call a political home, where there was always dissidents around and passionate conversations about politics, it becomes very difficult to allow yourself or to be allowed a space for which to think about these things that matter to you most. You know, when there's people are disappearing and being tortured, there's no space for you to talk about a painting. So the book became a way for me to bring all of these up. And because in my real life, these events have affected me, but also paintings and art and literature have affected me.
In a rave review of the book a few months back by Mishko Kakutani in the New York Times, she said that you wrote this memoir with both a novelist's eye for physical and emotional detail and a reporter's tactile sense of place and time. Obviously, you must have been very pleased by that review. But how different is writing a memoir than writing a novel? Do you employ the same techniques?
See, one of the things that worried me, I'll tell you, there are some surprises, certainly. But one of the things that worried me at the outset was, you know, notwithstanding all the evidence, I'm a very private man. And here I am talking about a book that is very personal. And being a private man, I'm not so easy talking about myself. And also, literature is littered with examples of people who put themselves at the center of historical events. And I wanted to avoid that. I wanted to bring in the reader as an intimate companion and use the only thing I have, which is myself, to focus on things, to expose things, to illuminate certain corners of the story, but not be the, you know, the heroic protagonist who's always standing in the way.
So there's always that problem of using the word I when you're writing about something like this.
Yes, and writing novels...
First-person novels different than writing I about yourself.
Absolutely, but one of the things that they make clear is that there's a great and complex and interesting distance between the pronoun I and the name of the author, even in a memoir. In other words, one of the surprises was that even though I am being as factual and exact as I am, although this book, because of the nature of my story, there are lots of black holes, unknowns that I fill with the imagination. So the imagination, in a sense, is co-remembering with me in the book. Nonetheless, I'm trying to be exact, honest, faithful. Yet, the surprise is that even when you're doing that, it is a deeply creative, inventive process. To remember anything, one has to exclude so much. And what you remember and the details that you choose to include affect how you're saying it. So I found it a very creative space. And, you know, there's a real paradox with this book because you know, as you know, it's about things that are very painful to write about. You know, it's very difficult to be, to sustain that space, psychological, emotional space, for the 3 years it took me to write it. But when I was in the throes of it, when I was in the middle of writing it, in other words, when I wasn't stuck or distracted or plagued by some sort of problem, it was a very thrilling space, because the range of the book, and I do think books are our fate. You know, as a writer, your book is your fate. You don't choose your book, but the book allows you certain things, and this book allowed a range of things, engagement into history, into art, and so on, that I found very thrilling.
And Colm Tóibín has called it, says, likely to become a classic. Hisham Matar will be speaking and signing books at McNally Jackson at 52 Prince Street on Sunday, October 9th at 1 o'clock. Then on Saturday the 8th, he will be in a panel at the New Yorker Festival at 1 o'clock at the Gramercy Theater. On November 7th, he'll be at the 92nd Street Y at 8 p.m. For more information, go to our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate. The book, The Return.